Welcome, everybody, to this meeting, Is America Back? My name is Christopher Coker. I am director of LSE Ideas, which is the foreign policy think tank of the London School of Economics. And I'm delighted to introduce our speakers today. First off will be Jussi Hänämaki, who has written a book suggesting that news of the death of the Transatlantic Alliance is mistaken, that it's survived many crises in the past, and that even if we look back at the Trump era, the last 4 years, we can see the alliance's strengths rather than its weaknesses. Jussi will say something about his book. He's Professor of International History and Politics at the Graduate Institute in Geneva, and author of a number of well-received works on the United States and the Western Alliance. And to discuss his book after he's spoken, we have Rosa Balfour, who I'm glad to say is an Associate Fellow of LSE Ideas, but principally Director of Carnegie Europe, with an interest in European security and foreign policy. Before that, she was a Senior Fellow at the German Marshall Fund. Then she will be followed by my colleague, Michael Cox, who's Founding Director of LSE Ideas, who is a well-known commentator on the United States and the Alliance and a historian of ideas as well, and set up the Cold War Studies Center from which LSE Ideas emerged. So he's well-placed looking back to tell us how critical relations are in the Alliance compared with, for example, the Cold War years. So what I'm going to do is ask each participant to speak for 10 to 12 minutes. And then I will ask Jussi to comment very briefly on the views that he's heard from Rosa and Mick. And then I will open up to questions from the floor. If you have a question, would you please send it in as we go along rather than leave it to the very end? The hashtag is hashtag LSEUS. It will be recorded and the recording will be available on our website early next week. So without further ado, Jussi, I will ask you to begin.
Thank you very much. Let me just before I get into the topic itself, just to thank Chris, of course, and LSE Ideas for hosting the event. Also want to thank Mick, a very good old friend who's joining us today, and Rosa Balfour, who I'm happy to have made acquaintance today, and we all, I think, associated with ideas. I'm proud to say that much of this book that Chris mentioned was actually written while I was a fellow at LSE Ideas about a year and a half ago, pre-COVID era, so to speak. The book, just in case anybody is interested, is called Pax Transatlantica. So it is a take on Pax Romana or Pax Britannica, if you will, with the subtitle America and Europe in the Post-Cold War Era. It's not, I would love to show you a hard copy, but I don't have one because it is actually hitting all good bookstores as of early next month. So it is Oxford University Press. So I hope some of you you'll find it perhaps amusing to have a look at some point in the future. So it is looking at a period of about 30 years. I will not give you a summary of the book as such, but maybe touch on some of the relevant points for our topic today, which is whether America is back since the disappearance of some sort during the somewhat controversial Trump era. My take on this is very simple one. In one way is that America never left, that in fact the United States returning to the fold and to normality is somewhat of an overstatement, that the United States, the role of the United States did not suffer it was not in a black hole for a four-year period that has just passed. And I'll make a couple of points on that. Obviously, I'm not going to say what if the result of the election in November would have been different, what would have happened. I cannot tell you that. That's something that we can maybe even discuss and speculate on at some point in the coming hour and a half. But Just to say that what sort of interests me and why I come to this, what lies at the basis of the book and also informs this talk is to my own experience in some ways of observing transatlantic relations over the past since the end of the Cold War, really, and even as a historian going back to the Cold War years itself, and it's been a roller coaster ride. I think to put it simply, it's been an endless series of ups and downs, of crises, conflicts, followed by periods of normality. I play a student, sometimes teach a transatlantic relations course to my students, and I started with asking them to place a quote that says something about a crisis in transatlantic relations. It's usually, you know, if I take a quote from the 1970s, say 1973, students will inevitably place it in 2002, 2003 in the Iraq War or even the Trump era or something like that. So there's been a sort of the relationship overall is been the usual thing. Is crisis, is conflict. And that's what also I think analysts have continually written about. Maybe it's just because crisis is so much more fun to write about than normality, and which is boring. But there is this sort of crisis mentality that discovered, I think, writing about transatlantic relations for a number of years now. And if you go and look up your bibliography on the topic in and do a little search, you will find that conflict and crisis and this and that will be the most common reference point in most of these articles. So my idea was to really think about, well, so what? If it's been crisis, there's been conflict, and yet things seem to be quite smooth in any number of structural levels that and there's been great successes in any number of things in terms of the transatlantic relationship itself. And I just want to make maybe three points to sort of which are in some more detail covered in the book, but maybe in terms of how they relate to this more recent history of the transatlantic relationship and the sort of doom and gloom that was very evident throughout the time since 2016, really, and was also evident very much last year during the COVID crisis, and as it hit the world in the spring of 2020. So my first point has to do with NATO, which is usually the optical lens that we look at the transatlantic relationship. And of course, if you look at the rhetoric on the last few years, we think about Trump and his comments about the obsolete nature of this alliance. I think that those are very, very well known, and that prompted a sense of crisis, his attacks on people like Angela Merkel and others. And of course, then on the other hand, we also had in 2019 President Macron, who would come out and tell in an interview that the NATO was brain dead and it didn't have a strategic sort of purpose or meaning anymore. And so there was this constant sense of, is NATO going to disappear? Is it becoming obsolete? Is America going to leave NATO, leave the Europeans on their own? And yet on the same side of the debate, there was this constant discussion and pressure on the magic 2% defense spending target, and which it turns out that in terms of what happened between 2016 and 2020 and had started to happen already before that, is in fact the Europeans had been starting to spend a bit more on defense. And so that sort of, to me at least, indicates on the European side very much the sort of desire and the need to meet expectations coming from North America, in this case from the United States, not only from the Trump administration, but the preceding administration as well, of doing more burden sharing, so to speak, in that regard. I'm not sure if the 2% defense target is a very good sort of analytical point on this, but it's sort of symbolic of the back and forth across the Atlantic over the years. So that's one thing that you see in effect, if looking at it from the US perspective. And you know, you could argue, and some have argued, and Trump himself has certainly argued, that this was just a way of putting pressure, of making the Europeans indeed pay a bigger share of the collective defense bill for NATO. And yes, to some extent, of course, this was indeed taking place. The other point about NATO that I think sort of underlines also the longevity of the alliance and the fact that it's not exactly in death throes at this point is a very simple fact, which is that NATO kept growing, even in the Trump era. In 2020, admittedly small North Macedonia became the latest NATO member to join the Club of 30. So it sort of begs the question, if there was a major crisis, if there's some existential problem for the NATO alliance, then why are Europeans paying more? Why are other countries joining NATO and so forth? And to me, it's simply, even in this atmosphere of crisis, atmosphere of transatlantic bickering and so forth, the structural importance of the NATO alliance for both Europe and, I would argue, the United States remained quite evident. And what we see also, of course, particularly in 2020, and is that there's a disagreement about what is the threat facing NATO. And I think where the Trump administration was doing something that goes probably beyond NATO is they were trying to build up to China as the latest menace that requires cohesion within the transatlantic alliance. So that again, I think, is a sort of classic case of where some of the geopolitical priorities and so forth among alliance members are not clashing, but there's disagreement, and not for the first time. So in that sense, that one could argue, in some ways, very little actually changed in the context of the Trump offensive on NATO. Now, my second point has to do with economics, about integration, about trade, and so forth. And of course, this is another long-standing issue in transatlantic relations, is that there's always some kind of a trade spat going on. There's some disagreement about tariffs, about trade terms, whether it has to do about importing bananas somewhere, whether it has to do with, Boeing and Airbus, and taking that particular case to the WTO. There's complaints and concerns about protectionism rising. And of course, Trump is famous for America First. He's famous for making the case that perhaps less so on Europe and more so on China, that there had to be some kind of fairer terms for the United States in this regard. The TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, was probably dead already before Trump was elected, or at least on hold, so to speak. But of course, any further discussions about in that regard were pretty much put on ice for the Trump term. So that's all bad news. That all seems to indicate that there's something terrible is happening in terms of transatlantic economic relations. And yet, at the same time, certain things never changed. The fact that the transatlantic economic space, so to speak, remains the biggest concentration of wealth on the planet, obviously never changed in the Trump era. The fact that while China is the major importer of manufactured goods to both the United States and to the European Union is of course true. At the same time, in terms of exports of goods, United States exports more to Europe and United States to Europe than either do anywhere else. The fact that the services trade across the Atlantic is massive. It's about one third, or I think about of the overall overall trade figures. And in contrast with services trade with China, it's the gap is absolutely massive. And thirdly, the fact that what you have is this long-standing rush of foreign direct investment across the Atlantic. And today, or in the last 10 years or so, still about 55% or so of European foreign direct investment goes to the United States, and the similar figures the other way. So there's something structural that is strong and not timeless, of course, but something that held up even in this atmosphere of all this talk about protectionism, of America first, of abandoning trade deals, and so forth. So that again, then one would argue that some of the coming United States coming back is perhaps an overstatement in this context. Now, the third point I'm going to talk about just very briefly, it has to do with politics. And that's, of course, the fun part. That's where and in particular, when we think about populism, when we think about things that you may have heard about, like Brexit and so forth. This is where I think much of the disturbing rhetoric emanates from the political arena. And I think while not all, certainly some of the rhetoric that we heard from Trump and then respectfully from others in Europe certainly goes, should be seen as part of something domestic, something that is aimed at the domestic electorate rather than see it as some existential crisis to international relationships. Populism is a phenomenon to many of us is of course very disturbing, at least the way we have been discussing it in recent years. It's also a phenomenon that is virtually timeless. As long as there's been some form of democracy, there have been so-called populists. We can go back to ancient Greece and ancient Rome and define examples if you want to do that. It is it's something, in other words, very, very long-term. It's a constant feature we can see in American politics. Whether we think about populists as, the term America First, of course, goes back to the 1930s, but it's also a transatlantic phenomenon. It's the underlying point that I make in the book, and what seems to, when we think about the last five or so years, it seems that much of the same kind of rhetoric, same kind of political tactics or strategizing seem to be going on across the board in the United States and in many, many countries in Europe. My own country, I'm from Finland, of course, and it's true Finns who were the sort of the equivalent of the UKIP, I guess, in the UK, or the Front National in France, or the Liga in Italy, any number of these types of parties, then we could see that some of that sort of messaging that comes from those parties is not that different from the messaging not only of Trump but before Trump, say the Tea Party, and so forth. So my point is not that this is necessarily a phenomenon that should make anybody sort of feel warm and cozy about what is being said. But simply to say that it underlines in some ways how the political systems and the political messaging are quite similar, more similar, I would argue, to in the post-Cold War era than in the Cold War era in some ways. That the juxtaposition that we've seen in recent years, in particular between the sort of nationalists and populists on the one hand, and then the establishment or the more I don't want to say neoliberal in any way, but the sort of internationalist, the liberal internationalist, I guess is perhaps the more appropriate word in this context. Now that kind of juxtaposition is something you do see across the board in the transatlantic space. It seems to me that what that tells us, or tells me anyway, maybe not to anybody else, what it tells me is that there is something very, very similar in the political processes and the questions that people are asking and politicians are trying to answer on both sides of the Atlantic. In simple terms, Americans and Europeans are more alike than we often like to think. And we've seen this, I think, over the past few years, even in the context of phenomena like the Black Lives Matter movement and so forth. I could go on that, and we can perhaps maybe revisit that point and many others later on. Maybe I just conclude very, very briefly by saying that the other point that really hasn't changed, and I think that applies to much of this, and particularly to my point about NATO, is how much the United States still matters to Europeans. That we saw that last November so clearly in display. It was easy, of course, follow how the election count went, because we were in lockdown in most places, and so there was nowhere to go. But it was fascinating to me how important American presidential elections are for Europeans, in a way that you would never ever see Americans staying up in the middle of the night wondering what's going to even happen in the Brexit vote in 2016. So in that sense, the dependency, which may be just a result of certain historical developments that we can go into, is as strong today, it seems to me, as it was has been over the past decades. And so, for all those reasons, for longevity of NATO, its growth, its success, for the economic integration process, that this is a transatlantic phenomenon, similarities in political evolutions, I would argue, on both sides of the Atlantic, the simple argument in terms of our question today, is America back, to me, is that yes, but it never left. And I think I'll leave it at that, and then I'll be happy to come back with a bit later on to comment.
Thanks very much, Jesse. Of course, Robert Kagan did argue 20 years ago, or almost 20 years ago, that Europeans and Americans were fundamentally different from different planets, from Mars and Venus, which was popular at the time, but you might want to say something about that. And can I ask you a question to which you might wish to reply when I give you the floor again, but please don't reply now, because you may think you don't want to reply to it. It seems to me that the big difference between NATO, or the Western Alliance, in the Cold War and the post-Cold War period is that although all these crises that you quite rightly say have been there since the beginning, on burden sharing, who's carrying the burden, who's not, where the main threat is it Central Europe, is it Southern Africa, is it Central America? That was, if you remember, quite popular 30 or 40 years ago. And also where the emphasis should be put on détente, or whether it should be emphasis on containment and defense. But they always agreed who the enemy was. There was only one enemy, and it was the Soviet Union, in whatever form the threat manifested itself. And today, of course, there is, a fundamental difference between the European Union and the United States in terms of who they see as the main strategic threat, or systemic threat, to use EU terms, to themselves, but perhaps not. So you may want to address that. But let's go straight on to Rosa, please.
Thank you very much, Chris, and thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed reading the book, and I appreciated very much the pairing of security and security economics and politics, and just drawing out the parallels and the similarities across the two sides of the, between the two sides of the Atlantic. I'm going to try and organize my thoughts around three points. The first is just try to think a little bit about where the transatlantic relationship stands now. What kind of juncture are we at? The second is about politics and democracy, and I have a few comments also on populism. And the third, I'd group more around the sort of international system and the challenges therein, in particular confronting the rise of aggressive authoritarianism. So let's start with where is the transatlantic relationship at this moment in time. And I agree with your basic argument that however disorderly, cacophonous, and sometimes litigious the relationship between the US and Europe has been historically, eventually it would, you know, it would coalesce around a set of shared goals, shared objectives, shared principles and norms. But we are probably at a time when that constellation is coming back again. And we're also at a time where we need to see what's going to be done in practice, because we've heard a lot of words, especially from the US. This is quite a clear, this administration has very clear messages. So we've heard a lot of words, but we need to see some action. But the thing that preoccupies me is that there isn't very much time, in the sense that the Biden administration is already a few months in. There'll be, you know, midterm elections coming up. We know the state of American politics is fragile and hugely polarized. So in 4 years' time, we could have another Trump or another Trumpism. And it's not so much a challenge, not necessarily so much a challenge for the transatlantic relationship. After all, Trump threatened and complained about NATO, but he didn't actually do anything to threaten its real existence. But there is a question of the degree to which the international system can be resilient in the face of repeated aggressions. And I think this is something that we need to look at. So where are we now? I said the Biden administration has quite clear messages, and we know that the overarching goal is to address the China challenge, which is seen, and there's bipartisan consensus that China's rise is per se a challenge. And in order to meet that overarching goal, the US has set itself a set of priorities. One is renew, reform, regenerate its own domestic polity in terms of economics, in the social level, the political level. So there's a lot really happening within the US to upgrade and to reform itself in order to address to heal the damage done in the 4 years of Trump, which of course, you know, reflected longer term trends within American society. The second goal, the second priority is to work with allies. And of course, Europe, including the UK, is a natural partner in this. And then the third goal is to restore the US's role in global governance and international organizations. And I won't speak too much about the US because what I know is more about Europe, although I do find that the Biden administration actually has quite a radical agenda, which is surprising perhaps given that he was elected on a rather moderate platform. But where is Europe in this? If we take this framing, coming from the US, this new framing to address contemporary challenges, where is Europe? And we could say that in terms of reforming itself, there is a clear strategic goal of addressing the economic challenges, especially the impacts of the pandemic, by regenerating the economy and transforming it into a green and digital economy. And there's a pretty clear strategy. And, you know, in all fairness, the EU has held its ground in pursuing these goals, however litigious the EU actually is within. But in terms of foreign policy vision, it's very unclear where the EU is going. It's quarreling with its main partner until the other day, that is the UK. It talks about reaching out to different allies, but it isn't actually pursuing that very much. It has been subject to several diplomatic humiliations in previous months. And these are not just episodes. These are the culmination of an inability of the EU collectively to play a role on the world stage, which does not bode well for the EU's ultimate goal, at least on paper, which is to support, defend and reform multilateralism, because it's part of its DNA, and an international multilateral system is what can make the EU thrive. Whereas what we're seeing is that where the EU collectively manages to make progress is less in an internationalist and open way, which is the way the US is proposing, even if the ultimate goal is to serve national interests. It's proposing a method which is multilateralist and internationalist. Whereas the EU, where it is making progress, is more in protecting its economy, protecting its borders, and that's where it seems to be investing. So it's not very clear to me where the elements of the partnership would be. Of course, we know that on multiple issues, the US and the EU are very close to each other, in particular with respect to the climate challenge, which probably is the biggest planetary challenge that we have. We also know that they are coming closer on certain issues that have been divisive in the past, technology, taxation for multinational companies. So there are areas in which they're moving together, but whether there is some shared goal at the moment, I think, is still unclear. And we need to see, there'll be meetings coming up in June coming up, and we'll see what kind of decisions come out of these meetings, because so far we've had words speeches, some better than others, but we need to see what actually is decided. And I think the key point really is how they are going to work together to preserve and improve the international system. But I'll move to this later, because I'd like to just focus a little bit on the sections on politics and democracy, which I thought was very interesting. I think perhaps I'm just slightly less optimistic than you are about the resilience of democracy. I mean, what we've seen is that the expansion of democracy that started with the end of the Cold War came to a halt in 2006 and has been contracting ever since. But we're also seeing a growing demand for democracy across the globe. We're seeing, in plenty of countries, many citizens, many people are willing to risk their lives to work to push for democracy. And we're seeing less of a commitment, less of an international commitment to supporting these movements. And I think this is something that is probably a consequence of the regime change mantra of the Iraq war, which you discuss in the book, that actually international support for democracy is diminishing. But in addition to that, I would also argue that the ability of advanced democracies to reform themselves in order to address the shortcomings that have allowed the rise of populism, that also is a question mark. We need to see whether Biden is going to manage to, turn his promises into action in terms of renewing democracy in America and in the rest of the in Europe. I don't see much of a discussion about what the democratic failures are in terms of representation, in terms of ensuring pluralism, in terms of expanding the space of political participation. All the debates are about essentially foreign interference, be it through disinformation or through cyber hacking, and not much about how can we actually improve the quality of our democracies to prevent further backsliding. And I say this, and this is where I have a slight disagreement with you about why populism has come about. And you mentioned rightly the Great Recession following 2007-2008 and the Eurozone crisis as one of the triggers. And also, of course, you mentioned the refugee influx 2015-2016. And I suppose more broadly, we can say, one is economic inequality. One cause of populism is economic inequality, and the other is identity and fear of loss of cultural identity and sense of belonging. However, if you then take these two hypotheses and you confront them with events across Europe, you'll find that some countries have had a populist party has grown in a context of economic prosperity, and countries that have been badly hit by the crisis, think Portugal or Ireland, that haven't had a surge in populist parties. Similarly, you had, I mean, Greece had both had an economic crisis and a refugee. It was, you know, it was on the border of the refugee crisis, but the far-right populist party did not manage to mobilize. I mean, there was a neo-Nazi party, the Golden Dawn, but there was never really a far-right populist party mobilized on national identity issues. So the actual picture is a little bit, I believe, more nuanced. And I think what brings them together, what brings these hypotheses together, the sort of meta level of explanation for the rise of populism is actually the decline of democracy, is that there is a demand for political participation. There is a demand to be represented in the discussions about policy choices. And some will demand to be represented more on the issue of economic inequality, and others perhaps on cultural identity. And this demand is not being met by politics as we know it, hence the rise of new parties. Hence, there is this space, a vacuum left by the old parties who were stuck perhaps in the, you know, pre-Cold War ideological framework. And that created a vacuum which allowed populist parties to rise. But I also think, whilst per se, if you look at sort of the classic definitions of populism, populism is not in itself anti-democratic, but it is anti-pluralist. And I think in complex societies, such as that those that we have in Europe and in the US, being anti-pluralistic and not being able to negotiate complexity and embrace several voices de facto means a risk, implies a risk to democracy. And I think, you know, what we've seen in Hungary, in Poland, and in the US, and here I will beg to differ, I think also in the UK, beg to differ with you because you don't see Brexit as a question of democracy, I do. I think because of this drift, we need to think of populism as dangerous to democracies, because the gray area between populism and authoritarianism is very gray. There's no real clear boundary. On this front, if I may just pose a question rather than a comment, just a question about, is this a transatlantic phenomenon? And I've always framed it as a phenomenon of advanced democracies, but I think we do need to recognize that there are populist leaders and populist governments elsewhere, and that perhaps should lead us also to question what our assumptions are. But again, I do think the risk is in the rise of authoritarianism rather than in populism per se. This leads me to my third point, which maybe I'll just make it a little briefer so that I give others the space to talk, to speak. And again, going back to, you know, are we at a critical moment and there isn't much time? I think, and I saw in the chat, there was already a question about the hijacking, the Belarusian hijacking of the plane. I think we really are living at a time when the international system is being severely challenged. It's no longer coexistence with authoritarian regimes who repress their own people. It's actually trying to change the rule book. This, I think, ought to provide, alas, it's a negative incentive, but it ought to provide a sufficient incentive for the US, Europe, and others to work together to make sure that that the international system and the rules upon which it's based is, to say the least, preserved. I would add also it needs reform, and that reform needs to come from Democrats, but at least it needs to be preserved. And if you think of, again, thinking of, you know, where there are more similarities than differences, if you think of the model that Russia and China are proposing for the governance of cyberspace, it is a state, authoritarian state-driven model focused on surveillance, on promoting surveillance and control, whereas the model proposed by the US and the EU is one based on multi-stakeholder approach involving private sector, but also involving civil society organizations, as well as governments, as well as, you know, multi-level institutions. So we have a completely different model, process, and end game, which will actually shape our future. But this has to be done soon. The time frame is getting shorter. And it was very hard to pursue these agendas while there was Donald Trump in the White House, which is why I'll go back to my initial point about, is this a critical moment and how much time is there? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rosa. In your earlier comments, I was thinking of a famous line in Ibsen's play Ghosts about friends. The problem with friends is that they do very little for you, but they prevent you from doing much for yourself, killed by association. So basically, it's a big question of interests or values. Is it time for the transatlantic relationship to revalue itself on the basis of interests rather than values? Are the Chinese right to say, we don't do alliances, we don't have allies, we do partnerships, and those partnerships are entirely interest-based? So that's just a question I throw out for you that, again, you may or may not wish to engage with when we open up the discussion. Let's move on to Mick, if you'd be kind enough to join us now.
Thank you very much. Am I coming across clearly?
Yes, loud and clear.
Well, first of all, thanks. First of all, congratulations to Yossi for his book. Wonderful title. With which I broadly agree, but in part disagree, particularly towards the end. Maybe Finland produces more optimists than I knew. But you're a little bit more optimistic about the present than I would be. Not that I'm a catastrophist. I don't believe in Zusammenbruch. I think the relationship in one form or another is going to endure, and you've given some reasons for that. Values, interest, economics, some common enemies, although we have some big differences about how we define the enemies and what we're going to do about them. And that is not unimportant, although that's always been there. Let me just make four big points. Firstly, about crisis, a much overused word. I know it's overused because I've been using it for the last 25 years, and everything is in crisis. And the transatlantic relationship, as Christopher alluded, and we kind of come from a similar generation, for everything we've ever known about that relationship, both at the NATO level and at other levels, it's always been in crisis. So, you know, for the study of the Korean War back in 50, poor old Clem Attlee had to rush off to Washington to hopefully try and stop the Americans bombing China. Well, that was a moment in the crisis in the relationship. They were never going to do it. I remember 1956. I actually can remember 1956 and the Suez Crisis. And that was a pretty big crisis, by the way. You know, the Americans pulled the plug on the British pound and got the British and the French out of the Suez area. Nobody I knew in Europe, although most of the people I knew were fairly dodgy lefties, as Christopher would well know, nobody particularly liked Ronald Reagan. And Reagan, well, you know, was a great divisive factor in Europe and indeed generated a fair amount of anti-Americanism within Europe himself. But you could even go back to the Vietnam War, go back to the 1970s. Even the 1970s, which was, everybody now calls it the long 1970s. I've always thought of it being the rather boring 1970s. That's another way, my way of thinking about it. Again, even in the 70s, there was a kind of sense of drift, not going anywhere. You know, Schmidt didn't like Carter, Carter didn't like Schmidt, etc. Even the end of the Cold War produced its own crisis, as you can remember. What's going to happen to NATO? I mean, I can't tell you how many really rather dull conferences I went to. Is this the end of NATO? Is this the end of the West? Because we no longer have, as Christopher alluded, we no longer have that strategic factor which touches all parts of the body called the Soviet Union. And in some would even say then that was a huge crisis. But even then, you know, if we're going to keep, you know, persist with this line of there, there's always been a crisis in the relationship. Even in the golden days of Bill Clinton, who the Europeans over generally tended to like, when you got to the Yugoslavian crisis, the collapse of former Yugoslavia, it didn't feel terribly at one with each other. I remember talking to a lot of Americans at the time saying, Europeans can't do anything. And anyway, by the way, do you remember where the peace was signed? It was signed in Dayton, Ohio, not in Rome or Germany. In other words, the Americans imposed the peace. And then they started moaning and complaining about NATO. You can't fight war by committee. Do you remember that one? You know, so they weren't too enamored with the NATO going into the 9/11, and 9/11 itself produced an enormous degree of unilateralism. We will do Afghanistan ourselves and not by committee. And Bush, of course, led to that, you know, another moment in the long history of the crisis. So Christopher mentioned Robert Kagan earlier on. The Europeans are from Venus, the Americans are from Mars, completely different outlook. That was a product of that time, although it even went back to the Clinton years, when he started writing the book, by the way, not during the Bush years, quite interestingly. Even the much beloved and now probably long forgotten Obama, except he's just written a huge book. Even Obama raised worries in Europe, you remember? He's tilting to Asia. He doesn't love us any longer. Please come over. He was very popular in Europe, overwhelmingly, certainly in the Western countries and in Britain. But nonetheless, he threw up some questions. He was also highly critical, if you remember, after 2008, which Rosie mentioned, after 2008, while Obama and his advisors like Tim Geithner and others, Bernanke, were pouring money into the American economy like there was no tomorrow, kind of Keynesianism on steroids, you know, the Europeans were going for austerity, particularly Germans in Germany, and the Americans were very unhappy about that. So when we get to Trump, the question is Trump part of a great tradition of crisis, or is he the anomaly? And it could well be that he's a bit of both, that he is a bit of both. And obviously the populist aspect of it has accentuated that, I think, as Rosa so ably explained. But on the other hand, even though he's part of a long tradition of thinking of a crisis and difficulties, there was something rather different about Trump. I'm bound to say this, in spite of my long historical discourse for every single American president since Truman, right through the Bush years, the two Bushes, and the Obama years, there was something really quite different. And I think, I wonder if that doesn't begin to tell us something that is a bit more critical about the relationship more generally. That's the question I think I'd throw your way, you see. You know, Obama said, I'm tilting to Asia and the Germans are not being good on economics and austerity. They didn't like Schäuble. But nonetheless, Trump was really something really new, even if he stood in what I call the long tradition, there always being a crisis, you know. No, nobody else before had ever asked questions about Article 5. Nobody ever said NATO may be obsolete, even though he didn't do anything about it, but he said it. You know, he regarded the EU as a competitor, not as an ally. And indeed, in general, you remember what he said about Brexit. Brexit is, you know, this is me. And that was not accidental. I think he was looking for the disintegration of the European Union. You know, and there's no other way of interpreting his words. He supported Boris Johnson. And Boris Johnson, by the way, who now wants to forget it, supported him very, very strongly indeed. So I just want to raise one big question to continue the conversation, which has been started by you, Yossi, and you, Rosa, on. Trump, I think, does represent part of a tradition of crisis, but there's something fundamentally different about what he represented and constituted in it. And let's be honest, secondly, you've counted the number of votes he got in 2020. It's just 74,200,000 or something, you know. He got 10 million more votes. Now, I'm not saying that's because of his European policies, all sorts of other reasons. But Trumpism, and I think there is a thing called Trump, has not gone away. It is still there in the DNA of American politics, and let's face it, you know, it could come back again. And by the way, Trumpism is deeply embedded in the American political structures now, into the Supreme Court, into a number of governors across the United States. Think how many Americans today, Republicans, still think that the election was stolen. So looking at it from the American side, which I'm doing more of, I think we've got to be very concerned that Trumpism has not gone away. Trump may have not gone away. He's still the most influential Republican that there is. Everybody's frightened to criticize him. And those who do, like Mrs. Cheney, you know, get booted out the window and out the door dead quick. And everybody read that very, very clearly. So yes, I agree with you overall, you see, you know, I mean, the fundamentals of the relationship, and it's a very peculiar and odd relationship, I think, it goes on, yet it goes on. You know, we keep calling it out. It's a bit like American decline. We keep saying it's going to happen, but somehow or another, it never does, in the sense that some people like Paul Kennedy back in the 80s said it might. And even I think I talked about this in the 70s. But yet it's not quite, it's declined to decline. And in the same way, I think the crisis has declined to turn into something really transformative and disintegrative. We've got to ask the reasons why. And I think that's where your book is so strong, because it points out to people who quite often don't like to think that things could just go on and on and on. You know, the economics of it, the security, the values, all these things, history, you know, the fact that the United States has come back to Europe three times in the 20th century, First World War, Second World War, the Cold War, you know, all these things are really deeply significant. And so I'm totally with you on that, but I still want to raise that question of whether it's actually a more critical state now than it's been before. And I know I said this back in 2003 when Bush was doing Iraq and everybody was talking about a great collapse of the transatlantic relationship. But I just wonder if it's not a bit different now this time round, and not just because of Trump, and maybe partly because of the reasons that were raised by Kagan back in his article in 2001, but maybe for other reasons as well. And I just want to think, what would those reasons be? And I'll say something about that very quickly. You asked the question, which I think was a great question, you see. The United States matters to Europe. Well, yes, of course it does, no question about it. As you pointed out very nicely, I always say, well, I always follow American elections, and although I like Canada, I never follow Canadian elections for 3 weeks and then stay up all night. But I do this with the United States. You know, I think we all do. And we know why it matters, you know, simply because the power of the United States and what happens in the United States therefore affects us all, not just in Europe, but across Asia, Africa, and the rest of the world. It tells us a hell of a lot about American power, but we are obsessed with it still. Come on. That's the way I kind of take it. And certainly in Europe, USA matters to Europe. But I think you could reverse that question, and I'd answer it in the following way. Europe matters to the United States as well. You know, I think this is really, very important to make this point. You know, deep affections for the United States in many ways, but I think an understanding that when they do stuff, they don't do stuff just out of the beauty of their hearts, or because they like Italian food or French wine, or British accents or British actors and actresses or whatever else. You know, they do it for pretty tough-minded reasons, and I would say there are three, and I think they remain pretty constant. Without Europe, I call Europe America's offshore base. You know, it's America's offshore base. Think throughout the Cold War without Europe. I mean, it's in some ways you could say that the United States cannot be a superpower without Europe, because it gives it that extended global reach. And that has continued after the end of the Cold War, as important as it was during a period of a divided Europe. Not just strategic, not just economic, but it's a sort of sense of what it is as a global power with global reach. And of course, this then brings us on to the other thing, that they have more in common with Europeans now more than ever. I mean, it's the truth of the matter is, you know, if you're sitting in Washington and looking around the world, you know, as Rosa pointed out so well, you know, you see a whole bunch of challenges to the liberal order. Some of them have come from inside the United States. Some are coming from populism. But you see Russia, you see China, you see other authoritarian regimes in the world. In that environment, which is deeply, I think, deeply destabilizing and disturbing, you'll look for your friends. You know, the old argument, you keep your enemies closer, but you also keep your friends very close. And whatever the differences are in that kind of critical environment, which I think is likely to become more critical as we move forward into the future, then a close relationship with the Europeans, however much you may disagree with them, all sorts of issues, is absolutely crucial. You know, in the end, you are going to phone up France, you are going to phone up the EU, you are going to phone up the Brits, you are going to phone up Berlin, you're going to phone up, you're even going to phone up Hungary, you know, because, you know, there's a certain alignment there, which is not to be found with any other relationship. And it's more than just economics, too, I think, although I think you're very correct to stress that. The other thing is, of course, America's a good hegemon, you know, does what all hegemons do, which is you try and manage your allies. And the more the United States has, you know, influence within Europe, whether for strategic reasons, economic, political reasons, or reasons to do with values, the more it manages the internal affairs of Europe and its foreign policies. In a sense, put it rather crudely, it stops Europe becoming independent as an independent actor with singing from its own hymn sheet. Now, that's where I kind of then bring my comments to a conclusion. And I'd be interested to hear what Rosa and you say, Yussi, as Christopher as well. Is it now that Europe is beginning to sing from a bit more of a hymn sheet? Maybe Rose has got some thoughts on that. What do we make of something called strategic autonomy? Is this just a nothing? Is this just a, you know, a little bit of fluff? Is this, however, something, is it a shape of the beginnings of something to come? I don't know. But it's not entirely irrelevant to thinking of how many Europeans, particularly the French and the Germans, I think, are starting to think of trying to do more by themselves. Now, I know that's been going on forever and ever and ever and ever, but Trump, again, delivered a real worrisome blow to the idea you can depend on the Americans. And if Trumpism has not gone away, then there's still a sense in Europe that you're not going to be able to depend on the Americans over the long term. Actually, if you see the response to Biden, just going back, because I did a fair amount on this, I've just written about this, it's quite interesting. Yes, thank goodness, Trump has gone, you know, break out the champagne, break out the Prosecco, break out whatever you want to drink. Yet, there was pushback. You know, it wasn't just, oh, it's wonderful to have you back, America's. No, there were questions asked, you know. There's still worries that Trumpism may be much more deeply embedded in America and that Trumpism is more than just one particular person. It does reflect something more problematic for making your own security depend on a country which you think may not be reliable over the long term or may have domestic problems which are not going to allow it to act in the ways that you want it to act. I'd also throw in one final point here, Christopher, because Brexit has been mentioned, and I can't not mention Brexit. I think Brexit is quite a large defeat for the Americans. I mean, nobody talks in those terms, but let's remember why they wanted the British inside the Europe in the first place, in the EEC, inside the EEC, and then in the European Union. You know, I'm not going to kind of start talking of Trojan horses, but the idea of having Britain inside the camp at the top table, with largely agreeing with the Americans on most issues, on trade liberalisation, enlargement to the East, which the British and the Americans were very much at one on, a whole bunch of other. The Brexit vote from that point of view, and I've written about this, I may have overstated it as I normally tend to do, but I think this was quite a major defeat for the United States. I think it's going to raise all sorts of problems for Britain. And I think that therefore gives America less leverage with inside the European Union as well. My very, very, very last point is really about Germany. I don't want to go on about this too much. But again, Rosa, you'd have a much better sense of this than me, I'm certain. But it does seem to me that the kind of arguments between Germany and the United States now seem to be almost unresolvable. Maybe I'm wrong. But the whole thing about Nord Stream, the gas pipeline, you know, there's a huge reservoir wanting to do it in Germany, and there's a huge dislike of this inside the United States, almost like it's become a touchstone of loyalty to the US. So I just wondered about that one as well. The final point I worry about, really, this keeps me awake at night, but certainly makes me worry. If Bidenism fails, if Biden is to fail, what comes next? I'm not making a prediction. I think Biden has done some pretty good things. I didn't like his decision on Afghanistan, but put that to one side. Nonetheless, if Bidenism fails, then I would worry a great deal about the future. Whatever the strengths of the relationship, which you bring out so well in your book, you'll see that would worry me a great deal about the future. So thanks again for your book. Thanks for Rose's comments and Christopher's, as always, wise words.
Thank you very much, Mick. And I'm glad you mentioned Afghanistan because you're the only person to have done so far. I disagree with you violently on that. I think that Biden's decision to leave is 20 years too late. And I'm delighted he's not reinforcing failure at the wish of his generals who promised to deliver a victory they could never actually deliver. But it does bring us to the idea that of your old friend, John Eikenberry at Princeton, has said that we have to move from liberal internationalism to defensive liberal internationalism. We have to start building back. It's Rosa touched upon this, and so did you, see. Because of populism, because of Brexit, because of other things, we have to start building democracy back up at home, rather than thinking we can export it abroad. And in his first speech at West Point, Obama did tell the cadets, 2009, but the nation I want to build is my own. and it's desperately in need of rebuilding. But it raises the question, how important is the United States? And you did, Nick, use the term superpower, which I think is not a helpful term, because I think the United States is no longer a superpower. And it brings to mind people like Steve Walt and others who say that the real problem the US has is facing that reality, that it's no longer a superpower, that it's living in a post-hegemonic world. It's no longer the hegemon. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to ask all the participants here what that post-hegemonic world means for the alliance, and particularly the critical relationship. You're quite right, Meg. The America's most critical relationship is with Europe for all sorts of reasons that you touched upon. But look, we have quite a few questions, and I'd like to open it to the floor. And I'd like, first of all, Yossi, for you to reply to what you have heard from Rosa and from Mick. And then I'm going to go straight through to the floor. And Mick and Rosa, you can come back on some of the questions I asked or any other points that come into your mind when we come to the Q&A session. So over to you, Yossi.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Chris. Thank you, Rosa. Thank you, Mick, for your comments. I don't think there's any point in me trying to address all of your comments and points and criticisms, unless since we do want to get to the Q&A, which brilliant though as we all are here in the program, listed in the program, I think we will probably learn more if we pass the baton to others. At least it'll make us respond to different questions. So maybe I just take a couple of points somewhat randomly perhaps, but maybe one from each of you. And Chris, you asked in the beginning about the lack of a big enemy. And I think, I mean, you're right. And that's one of the starting points actually of the book, is that things did change. My students don't remember the era when there was a Berlin Wall and all those wonderful symbols of a divided continent and so forth, and a divided world, et cetera, but things did change quite significantly in the late 1980s and early 1990s. The flag was lowered from the Kremlin and it was no longer there. There was one country, became 15. There was no more Warsaw Pact. All of that changed. And that obviously then, and Mick was party, as he told us, off these conversations and discussion about what now, you know, do we need NATO? We don't have a Warsaw Pact. We don't have a Soviet Union. What's the point of NATO? And you know, George Kennan was of the opinion that, no, we don't need NATO anymore. And in fact, if we keep it, it's going to create more problems than you know it's worth. So yeah, and yet NATO is still there 30 years later. It's bigger than ever. I'm not going to say better than ever. I don't know what that would mean in this context, how you measure good and bad in terms of alliances. I'm not quite sure, but it is still there. So it is responding obviously to something that is either external to NATO or internal to NATO. And I like to emphasize the fact that it serves both purposes. And I think increasingly since the end of the Cold War, it's become more of a glue for the member states that it's become. And you know, in some ways, this underlines the point Mick was making in that you know, okay, Europe needs the United States, but yes, also the United States needs Europe. And what else do they have? What else historically, you know, sound and long-term is there than NATO, over 70 years old now, and so forth. So I think that's part of the, perhaps part of the answer. There isn't a single existential type enemy in the form of the Soviet Union, communism, and so on. I think there have been attempts to build those types of enemies over the past 30 years. Terrorism, of course, was one, and you know, the axis of evil, all of that. Europeans did not buy into that, and the Americans didn't buy into it so long either in the end. And that's why Afghanistan is now sort of becoming old news in that regard. It won't help Afghanistan at all. The last 20 years haven't helped Afghanistan all that much either. So, I mean, you know, this is another conversation, but it is probably a decision that was inevitable at some point or another, no matter who was going to be in the White House. So that's one thing. If there is an existential enemy that is now being built up, it obviously it's not authoritarianism as such. I think it's in particular China, and that's sort of the project that was ongoing, is my guess, in 2020 when Mike Pompeo was going around Europe and trying to get everybody to see how deeply, you know, how much worse China is than the Soviet Union ever was as a threat, and so forth. I'm not sure how many bought into that particular argument, but there's, you know, there's some ingredients in that, in a sense that also underlines the need for the United States of the transatlantic alliance in terms of NATO, because as a political institution rather than a sort of purely military defense organization, which arguably it never was in the first place. So maybe that if there is, you know, broadly speaking, you don't necessarily need that big enemy in order to, and I think the last 30 years sort of prove that you don't need that that big enemy to keep an alliance not only in place but growing. And so I think that would be my sort of reflection on, rightly or wrongly, on that particular point. Now, I think both Rosa and Mick think I'm much too optimistic about where we are, that this is an urgent moment. I'll just say two things on that. One is that I've been in urgent sort of moments, and Mick sort of said this himself. We've been in urgent, crisis moments before. I remember very well in 2002, 2003, I happened to be at the Wilson Center in Washington, and all these discussions about, you know, when the French, became surrender monkeys and freedom fries were the latest addition to McDonald's repertoire instead of French fries, and, you know, all of that sort of throwback to another era again, in which this sort of thing and you know, the sort of real crisis that the French and the Germans, because they were not supporting the United States on this particular expeditions, they were really worse than the Iraqis, actually, at least rhetorically speaking. And I raised the point that, well, you know, okay, it's an alliance crisis, but, you know, there's already Vietnam, right? 30 years ago, and we had similar discussions. Well, the answer was that I got usually was, well, Vietnam wasn't so central to American foreign policy, whereas Iraq is. Now, any historian would say that, well, that's at least in the minimum debatable, right? So that would be one point to sort of, if not to say be optimistic, but certainly don't be too pessimistic about these sorts of things. And the other point about the argument I think that you have about being pessimistic relates really to the political evolution, if you want to put it that way, Trumpism, as you pointed out, as we sometimes call it, or the sort of, you know, populism a la, I don't know, from UKIP to Front National to Liga to whatever, which is, I mean, to me, that's a phenomenon. It's whether or not I see it as a danger to democracy. There's been a lot written about it. There's been a sort of lot of theorizing about how, in fact, a populist one, you know, populist, however defined, and it's a very, very tricky definition to, it's sort of like terrorism. How do you define this particular ism? Who is a terrorist, right? So who is a populist? It's a bit tricky. Bernie Sanders? Well, you know, we can, you know, go into that discussion if you will, but it's not populism to me is not an end in its own right. It's a tool. It's a tool of political mobilization, if you will. That's how I see it, maybe rightly or wrongly. I know that today there's been so much written about populism that we all seem to know that populists, they are right-wing nationalists, or they are, you know, anti-EU people. They are sort of Trumpists, everybody who supports Trump in the United States. I think it's should be, you know, rethought what we simply to one extent what we think about it. The second reason I would say my optimism about, you know, Trump, you make rightly point out that Trump is still there and Biden is there. Now, the thing about them is that both of them are going to be quite, as the French would politely put, âgé. They already are. Last year's presidential candidates topped the previous presidential race in one way, in that they were the oldest yet again. So to me, I mean, what this means is that certainly as personalities, the people that we see in the United States in the top of the political ladder, this is a generation that's not going to, if you think in terms of even the medium term future, we are like unlikely to see these particular personalities as being the ones that we're going to juxtapose. On the other hand, I have no doubt that the debate between those who favor the sort of internationalist liberal agenda, you know, multilateralism, all of that, and those who are sort of America first types in the United States, that's going to continue. That's been there. It didn't start with Trump. Trump was charismatic enough to make it into the defining thing. And even we like to now talk about Trumpism as some kind of an ism in it, which I don't know what it is really, but fine. And similarly, I think the sort of nationalist type, call them populist movements across Europe, they also were not invented. I mean, if there's an impression that I said that everything starts with the Great Recession, no. There are plenty of roots to all of this that lie across Europe. One of the oldest populist parties or right-wing nationalist parties, if that seems to be the same thing in many people's minds, is the Swiss People's Party. And that goes back to the late 1970s, early 1980s. And, you know, it was very much the sort of bunker mentality, you know, build walls or rather keep the mountains high around Switzerland so that we don't get all these migrants coming in. So it's, you know, there is that sort of, and it's always been attractive. And you can see it in US politics as well, of course. Anti-immigrant message is not something that Trump invented when he descended on the escalator and started saying nasty things about Mexicans, right? It is something that for which there was a general audience. And I'm not optimistic about that. I doubt that sort of the debates are going to get any nicer in that sense, in the United States or in Europe. What I have some, perhaps more faith than maybe my colleagues here is that debate is also, because it's been going on for so long, because somehow these democratic systems have survived, and maybe it's the Finnish origin or something, but I sort of seem to have perhaps more of a faith in that. Listen, I better stop because
yeah,
I have a limited time.
But thanks very much, Izzy. Yeah. We've only got 15 minutes left, and unfortunately, there are quite a few questions. Let me just tell you what the questions are, and then I'll ask you to address them. Two questions about contemporary events. Of course, what's been happening in Belarus recently? In other words, how do you deal with Russia as a rogue state, an awkward state, a spoiler, whatever you want to call it? Another question on Palestine, is this likely to be a wedge, produce a wedge between the US and Europe? Because the two have often disagreed on that particular issue in the Middle East. General questions about the crisis of liberal capitalism since 2008, and also the dysfunctionality of the United States. So I suppose putting it quite crudely, is it still worth having the United States as an ally if it's on the brink of dissolution? To put it very dramatically, the meaning of NATO, is it an offensive or defensive alliance? And that's a question from Mozambique. So it's a very interesting idea. How do others see NATO rather than how do we see it? And I think I'm going to leave it there. I can't do justice to all questions. I apologize to those who've asked them. Here they are. We have 14 minutes or so. Rosa, if we could start with you and then Mick, and then you see if you could sum up at the end. But please bear in mind the clicking, the ticking clock. Thanks. Rosa, you need to unmute.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to refer to a rather brilliant and intriguing article that came out in War on the Rocks. Now, it must be 2 or 3 years ago, about Russia, comparing Russia to one of these medieval adventurers that would go into villages, raid a bit, and then go back. So create damage, but not systemic damage, and then go back. And I think that's how Russia has evolved its policy since 2014. And that's why I was insisting so much on the international system and existing rules, which we know are not sufficient, but they have helped ensure a fairly long relative peace, right? And since the annexation of Crimea and the limited pushback that this event has had, I think, you know, some states are playing around, and with the Trump years being a great enabling period, some states have been playing around with borders, with other populations, with international law. And I think that's basically the big challenge that I wanted to point out. Let me just take another quick look at the question. So the Belarus, the hijacking of the plane by Belarus fits in this. You know, to what extent do Europeans and Americans want to actually really push back on this and say this is a red line that cannot be passed? And I actually don't know the answer yet, because at the same time, the US and Russia have planned a summit, and the US is being quite pragmatic with respect to Russia, because China is actually the most important goal on that matter. What else? I don't think there was a question about the US. I don't think the US is on the brink. And I do think, and having worked, it's 6 years now that I work, I mean, Carnegie is a global think tank, but the headquarters are in Washington. And before I was at the German Marshall Fund, which is an American think tank with many offices in Europe, I have direct experience of how Americans can bounce back and they can reinvent themselves rather quickly in ways that I think are not part of, we're not used to that sort of frame of mind in Europe. So I think the US's capacity for renewal is very strong. So I don't think the US is a partner on the brink. I do think that ultimately the reason for which we're in the current predicament is also because, as part of the hegemonic space, we haven't thought attentively and sufficiently to the rest of the world. And we haven't thought of multilateralism in an inclusive way. We haven't thought about it in a participative way. And now we're dealing with the hubris that this has caused. And that's why dealing with Russia, China, and others is complicated. I'm not sure I've answered all the questions. There were quite a few of them.
There's one on Palestine and the Middle East generally.
Well, again, Europe has changed its position, really. I mean, it's always had, in statements, it's always had a long-standing commitment to a two-state solution. But then we're seeing some member states, entertaining a different quality of relations with Israel. So I see this as a hugely divisive issue within the EU, and I don't see the EU as being able to forge a common position, if not on providing humanitarian support or economic or support for reconstruction in Palestine. So Europe really has moved backwards in this sense, at least from the point of view of unity. Whether it ever had an effective strategy, I think I would say that it hasn't. So, you know, to some extent, you could say it's irrelevant. But Europe has really, its own position has unraveled on the Middle East. And I think this has happened, it certainly happened during the Trump years, but it might have happened anyway.
Thank you. Mick. Mick, are you there?
Same, don't we?
Microphone, yeah.
No, sorry about that. I always thought Obama had the best line on Russia. You know, Obama came from Chicago, his political life was spent in Chicago. He came from somewhere else, of course. And he said, "Well, Russia's very difficult. You know, they tried to reset the relationship back in 2016, and it really foundered badly." although he did end up with a nuclear deal, which also should not be underestimated. But he said, well, you know, dealing with Putin and Russia, which is a sort of KGB capitalism largely, which is a pretty good definition of Russia, I think. It's a bit like a dealing with a Chicago-style gangster with three differences. One, they got nuclear weapons. Two, they got oil. And three, they got a veto at the United Nations. I think there was a terrible tendency in the 2000s, in the 1900s, in the 90s, to write Russia off. You know, Russia was in decline. Russia was in decline. It doesn't add up to very much. And, you know, I think Putin in some states has proven that argument wrong. Now, it doesn't make it like China. And therefore, the problem that it presents for the West is very, very different, as Rosa points out, to the difference that China represents. Because basically, China's got a lot of money, a lot of manufacturing, and a lot of technology, and has moved beyond oil to underpin its budget. And to some degree, you could say it also acts a bit more cautiously, to say the least, than does Russia. But I just don't know what you do with Russia, to be perfectly honest. Because what do you do if you take Obama's kind of definition as being as close to something called the truth? Then how do you deal with a Chicago-style gangster? Because it is slightly gangsterish behavior. How do you deal with that? You know, I mean, you used to lock up gangsters or put them away somewhere or bribe them to stop. And I'm very pleased, however, that the United States is still keeping open some door to Russia. And I think this is going to be the biggest challenge too for the Europeans as well. How to maintain and sustain unity towards Russia when there's clear differences within the European Union on Russia. And I think managing that relationship is going to be very, very difficult because Russia doesn't make it at all easy. On the question of NATO, it's a double-edged answer to the question. To those who argued for NATO enlargement, it was an expression of self-determination, and it was an expression of a defensive alliance of like-minded democracies to bring them together because they didn't want partnership for peace because that was the halfway house that nobody wanted to be in. To the Russians, of course, increasingly it looked like an aggressive design to engage in encirclement. So it all depends where you're sitting in relationship to NATO. And certainly Putin has exploited the argument. And by the way, you mentioned Steve Walt earlier on, Christopher. His good friend and my good friend, and yours too, I think, John Mearsheimer, wrote a very powerful article in the Foreign Affairs saying the crisis in Ukraine is not Russia's fault, it's NATO's fault for enlargement. Now, we can debate that, of course. But again, that narrative that NATO, in a sense, has been the cause of some of the problems that we're now facing with Russia is one that also has a resonance in the West. And I think that's not insignificant in terms of public opinion in the West and public opinion, particularly in Europe. On dysfunctionalism in the United States, I broadly speaking agree with Rosa. I mean, it's a very conservative, stable, property-owning democracy in the last analysis. You know, the 6th of January 2021 is not America in the totality. You know? And so therefore it has very, very deep sources of stability and order. You know, one of the most religious countries in the world, you know, I mean, people, you know, they buy into the flag, they sing the national anthem. It's got a huge capacity for socialization. So but what does worry me is the phenomenon of Trumpism. I think it is still there. And it can come back to bite the situation. That's why I'm saying I'm worried that if Biden fails, then Trumpism walks into a vacuum, and that vacuum could be destabilizing for policymaking in the United States, even though I don't see the United States itself disintegrating. Far from it. There are many other questions on Israel. Obama tried to take a more even-handed approach and got stung for it politically back in Washington. And that all got locked into the whole Iran deal as well. You can't leave that out of the formula because for Israel, Iran is the key question. And in some ways, I'm not sure one's going to see any big changes in US policy towards Israel, towards Iran. And I think that there's the continuity as well. So I think that's all I want to say, Chris. You may want to come in.
No, thank you very much, Mick. Yossi, would you like to just say some concluding remarks?
Yeah, thanks. So there's lots of really good questions here on the Q&A on the chat, and I think Rosa and Mick already addressed a lot of them. There is the problem of Russia is sort of like the problem of Maria in was it the Sound of Music or wherever that line is. It's you know, map is what it is. I know this coming from Finland, so you know. You can't change the map, and you can't change history. You can't change certain things that have happened. I think there is disagreement, of course, within among the 30 NATO members about how to address that, and that can depend. You know, Finland, by the way, not in NATO, so it's not out of this discussion to some extent. But obviously, I mean, this is the big question, because NATO still is the Atlantic Alliance, and its main member states are in Europe. And of course, given Ukraine, given all the things that have happened, given the hijacking, as we now call it, or the forced downing of an airplane to get a dissident out of a plane and put him in jail. Sort of talk about gangsterism of sorts. Those types of events. They obviously remind everybody about what's going on. You know, the Crimea is still an unresolved international legal issue. I mean, there's clear lines of argument, but what are you going to do about it? Is somebody going to go to war for that? Not anytime soon, I would imagine. So it remains a huge issue, and of course, in the end, I think ultimately. The relationship of NATO with Russia will, again, I come back to the point of the United States being in many ways another hegemon, then certainly a decisive player in all of this. So, yes, so Vladimir and Joe will meet in my current hometown, Geneva, next month. We don't know what's going to come out of it, but again, this is a sort of one of those things that also is shaping, I think, concerns and about Russia and how it is. I think Mick is absolutely right about sort of how that narrative has been played out, especially in Russia, of course, to say that this new encirclement that's happening, hence we have to defend. So there's that. I think overall, and I come back to the point of being a relative optimist. I think it's great that both Mick and Rose think the United States is not going to be in a civil war and collapse anytime soon. I think that, so I don't have to repeat that point, I think, today. It's just to maybe his last words, just to thank everybody for coming here. I think it's been a great, to me at least, it's been a very interesting conversation today. So thank you all for, you know, Chris and Mick and Rosa for being here, for organizing it. And let me, I wanted to thank our, who's there in the, who did the technical?
Dave Sutton.
Dave Sutton, yeah. Dave, just to thank him as well for
our events manager
being there to organize it. So,
well, thank you very much, Jussi. And David's just posted up 5 minutes ago the details of your book. So hopefully you'll make a few royalties today. I don't think it'll make a big difference. Who knows? Thank you, Rosa. Thank you, Mick, very much for joining this conversation. Thank you, Jussi. Thank you for the participants for staying with us and asking the questions. I'm sorry you couldn't do justice to all of them in the time, but it's a very important issue. And I'll just leave you with the conversation, telephone conversation between Biden and Putin a couple of weeks ago, when 100,000 Russian troops were massing on the Ukraine frontier. Apparently, it was a full and frank discussion, as they say in the United States, but it's the kind of conversation that Angela Merkel could not have with Vladimir Putin. And perhaps that's the reason why Europe is still tied, for good or ill, to the United States. It's as Mick, you would say, at the end of the day, it's about power and making use of the power that you actually have, which is called politics. And thank you so much to everybody for discussing the politics of the alliance. And I hope you'll join us again for another LSE Ideas event. Goodbye for now.
Right. Thanks a lot.
Everybody. Cheers. Bye. Bye.